Okay, let's fade that music out. And what I'd like to do is play you a little snatch of Elena Katz-Chernin, which is not The Waltzing Wombat. It's called The Uninvited Stranger, and I'll tell you of its significance after you've heard it.
Who is this uninvited stranger? Who is this uninvited stranger that speaks at me, that speaks at me, that speaks at me? Uninvited stranger that speaks at me. Who is this uninvited stranger? Who is this uninvited stranger that speaks at me, that speaks at me, that speaks at me? Uninvited stranger that speaks at me.
You can see why I'm a great admirer of Elena. Isn't that terrific? The Uninvited Stranger, a piece she composed a few years back to accompany a poem by my next guest, Sandy Jeffs. Now, obviously, you've right to deduce that Sandy's a poet, 5 published volumes under her belt. She also lives with schizophrenia and has done so for the last 33 years, and she's written a book about her experience called Flying with Paper Wings. Lovely title. Now, when she's not writing poetry, Sandy is a public voice, almost the public voice, for what it's like to live with a mental illness. And she's a public speaker at SANE. She grew up in Ballarat, Victoria, and now lives outside of Melbourne, where she joins me on the phone. And before I say hello to Sandy, I'd like to thank Anne Deverson, an old friend of the program, for telling us Sandy's story. Sandy, welcome to our little wireless program.
Thanks, Phil. Well, thanks for having me.
A delight. Now, you describe yourself as living with schizophrenia. Is that because even when you don't hear the voices, when you're not delusional, it's impossible to forget that you have the illness?
It's something you live with constantly when you have it. You find yourself always musing, am I mad again? Is my behaviour appropriate? Is what I'm saying appropriate? Am I deluded yet again about something quite insignificant? It's an illness that has a course that it runs, but it's always with you. And you always live with a constant fear. When will I next embarrass myself? Who will it be in front of? Where will I be when I do something stupid?
I'm going to read a fragment of your poetry. When sanity had given way to reclusive imagination, I walked tall and deluded. Now I bask in the joy of being at home, complete, mindful of the capricious time when my mind was pierced by the steely shards of madness. Sandy, you quote that wonderful line from A Streetcar Named Desire, I've always depended on the kindness of strangers. Have you got kindness from strangers? Have strangers over your difficult years been helpful?
Yes, I had one incident in hospital where there was a very kind stranger. I'd been actually admitted by these people who had abused me in the formalities of admitting me to hospital. And I was sitting in the day room weeping that night. It was about 10 o'clock at night time. And this woman came up to me and started brushing my hair in a very meditative and gentle way. And she spoke no English. She spoke some Eastern European language. But her brushing of my hair made me transcend where I was to a place that was kinder and where people weren't all monsters. And I just remember that so profoundly because it was in a place that was dark and cavernous and a place that was full of drama and turmoil. My own turmoil as much as anyone else's, and she broke through the barrier.
Brushing the hair, it's so intimate and gentle, isn't it? Now, you also use one of your other weapons in coping is humour. You call the two voices in the head that from time to time torment you, Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Now, I've always been very fond of those two fellas. tell the gladies why those names, and secondly, what do they say to you?
I call my voices Tweedledum and Tweedledee to try and wrest from them the control they have over me and to mock them before they mock me. So the voices in my head, there's a couple of them. There's two voices that give a running commentary on me in the third person, And there's also a whisper that has a very insidious, awful way of undermining the way I feel about my friends and life in general. And
so they can just come into your mind at any moment.
Any moment. And I have triggers. Like, I have a friend who of mine, very dear friend, who is a trigger for the voices, unfortunately. I find night time is a particularly bad time for my voices. And
it's
so
a bad time for everything, I think, really.
I have an MP3 player where I listen to Beethoven and other music at night time when I find the voices are intrusive and berating me.
Yeah, and I understand that at the beginning, though, in some way, resembled the voices of your parents.
Yes, they did. In the beginning, they were the voices of my parents who were having an argument about me in my head and saying really weird things, like my mother calling me the angels. I forgot what she said now, something like the angels' servant or something, and my father calling me a railing bitch and
aren't parents wonderful?
Well, in fact, the voices as they've come down through the years with me are like parents who berate their child relentlessly.
But you now make the point, I think this is absolutely funny, that recently they've taken on a posh persona. They've become more eloquent, and you think they've done elocution lessons.
Yes, well, that's what it's like, because they were pretty crass. I mean, they're very crass and a very foul mouth, but they do it with a posh accent. And in fact, they would give a very nice poetry reading, much better than I would do. So they've done elocution in the last couple of years. But in a sense, though, they're very harrowing voices, and they're very persecutory, berating me and mocking me. They always pronounce on things that I'm doing, and as I evolve, they evolve. As my life changes, they change. For example, when I started playing hockey, they started saying that my team hated me, that the coach was sending telepathic messages to George W. and Condi about me.
Look, I think all of us, no matter what our mental state, have a sort of running commentary, a critique going on, you know, as we negotiate and walk and talk and muck about in life. But to have them as obsessive as Tweedledum and Dee, boy, oh,
look,
boy.
We all have a voice of our conscience. You do something and a voice goes, oh, you shouldn't have done that. But these voices that I hear, they're as real as me speaking to you, Philip, or you speaking to me. Mm. They sound external. They are totally compelling. They give admonishments. They give commands. I sort of describe the voices as parasites, because without my mind or brain, they couldn't exist.
Yeah.
And they feed on my internal world.
Well, as you're well aware, schizophrenia is now one of the explanations for, say, Joan of Arc, hearing her voices. And who knows, you may attain sainthood down the track.
if only.
When did you first realise that something wasn't right? How old were you?
Well, I was sent into the world rather melancholic and troubled by my parents, because my mother was an alcoholic and my father was a wife beater. And he used to accuse my mother of, he'd say to her, oh, you're mad thing, you need to see a psychiatrist. So as I was entering into adulthood at university and finding myself very troubled at that time, particularly in first year uni, wandering around corridors all night and sleeping all day and having a really bad lifestyle that was evolving, I just think that I was unravelling from then on, but I was too fearful to seek counselling because it was tantamount to saying I was mad.
Well, isn't it an irony that voices are impinging on you, but you can't talk back at that time? You know, you're too frightened to talk about it.
I couldn't talk about things, and as my life evolved after university, when I couldn't get a job and I was floundering around feeling really vulnerable but also lacking self-confidence, I found that my voices started taking over. And by the time I was diagnosed when I was 23 and I actually had told a doctor I was hearing voices, it was as though the voices had always been with me, as though I'd never been without them.
Of course, the other problem is you are in a society which is still, after centuries of treating people with mental problems so badly, still doesn't begin to understand and is often very clumsy and inept.
Yeah, I think society's had a very challenging and challenged relationship with people who are mad. And I think what happens is that people project their own fears of going mad onto people who are mad and then start to vilify them and stigmatise them.
Well, there's a lot of fear in it. I often tell the story with great shame about when I was 4 or 5 years old, no, 5 years old, coming home from East Kew School, and we'd persecute this Down syndrome child in a playground. Yeah. And the reason we did it, you know, I can still remember it as though it was yesterday, the reason we did it was because he frightened the hell out of us.
Yeah, I think that's right. I remember a woman in Ballarat who used to go around preaching the Bible at people. And I'm sure when I look back now, she had a mental illness.
Mm. And of course, back in 76, the treatments for schizophrenia were fairly, you know, were pretty vague, weren't they?
It was vague. And I remember when I was diagnosed with schizophrenia, I thought, my God, I've got this awful label attached to me. And it was seen then as the cancer of psychiatry, because schizophrenia was seen as this relentless journey into unreaching and unreachable madness, and from which one would never recover. And with each episode, you would just go deeper and deeper into madness. So the prognosis was really appallingly poor. And it was scary, you know, and I had this terrible fear that I would end up with no friends, a bag lady on the street begging for money, begging for food and begging for a bed from the Selvos.
To what extent did you call upon religion? I know you were raised as a Protestant and you went to Sunday school. You must have felt abandoned by God.
I felt very abandoned by God, because I remember when my parents were fighting, I'd retreat into my bedroom and pray to God to please stop Daddy from hitting Mummy, and also to pray to God to please stop Mummy from drinking. And so I lost my faith in God very early on, but I flirted with Catholicism in my late teens and early 20s, because it was such a ritualistic, beautiful religion. And I remember that St. Patrick's Cathedral in Ballarat was a beautiful church with lovely stations of the cross and candles and incense and flowers, and really opulent but artistic. And I think that at the Catholicism then was reaching out to the unformed poet in me, because it's a very poetic religion.
Well,
very
as you've written somewhere, there's an intimate connection between religion and madness in general, and in your own case. And
yes.
You now strive to stay entirely within the rationalist of the intellect to keep irrationality at bay. So
yeah.
When you finally distance yourself from Catholicism, you kept going and now reject all religion?
I have. I find myself an atheist. I can't even say I'm an agnostic, and thinking that maybe there is something happening out there. I can't see past their flawed material selves at the moment. And I sort of wonder that I sort of hanker for some transcendence of some sort, and I can't get it in religion, but I think I found some sort of transcendence in my poetry.
You write that we may never understand what makes us mad, but we can seek to understand what makes us well. Apart from poetry, what makes you well?
Well, actually, I was with my psychologist just this week, and she said to me, we're going to have to review our sessions and what's going to happen in them. And I said to her, well, it's a very simple question. What keeps me sane? And I think the answer is seeing my psychiatrist and my psychologist at the moment, but also my friends are very important in my life, music's very important, and my sport's very important, as well as my poetry and writing.
We did a program a couple of years ago with a very distinguished woman in the US who's, like you, has been very public about her schizophrenia. And I remember she was astonished to discover that psychiatry, no pills, no drugs for quite a while, that the so-called talking cure gave her a lot of help.
Yeah.
Has it helped you?
It has, and I had one therapist for a long, long time who did talk to me in the beginning, but like psychiatry over the last 30 years, I witnessed in her and psychiatry a change in approaches. I think psychiatry's gone from talking to people, because you know, the word psychiatrist means healer of the soul. It's gone from talking to people to medicating people, and I think that's...
And many psychiatrists regret that. My daughter is a shrink, and because of the immense pressure on people to get results, she has to prescribe
yes, they
pills.
Do.
But she wishes she didn't.
No, well, I mean, I have found a psychiatrist now who talks to me and takes me seriously as a writer and as an artistic person. What I would say to psychiatrists, and I've said this before to them in talks, is that you can medicate the brain, but you have to talk to or engage with a mind. And I think the psychiatrist has forgotten to do that. It's become infatuated with psychopharmacology, and I think to the detriment of the talking cure. I think also I call now what psychiatrists do sometimes McDonald's therapy or fast psychiatry.
Yeah.
Because it is about processing people quickly and trying to get quick results. But I think with mental illness, it's as much about the therapeutic relationship that helps people as much as anything else.
But you also put a lot of energy into making friendships.
I do. And that's been my strategy all my life, even when my parents were so dysfunctional and unhappy, that friends were always my source of solace and comfort and a source of strengthening myself, I suppose, because I had this capacity and ability to make friends and keep friends. But I have friends from 30-odd years ago that I still have in my life.
I understand you've still got a teacher friend, Miss Vines.
Miss Vines.
Yeah, who was kind to you at Ballarat High School.
Yes, I do. I still see her now. She's probably listening tonight, actually. She was a teacher who changed my life, and I think some kids have this experience in school where a teacher has actually helped them to the extent of changing their lives.
And I had a couple of those, and I love them very much. Yeah,
aren't they a godsend?
Yeah. Well, I'm not into godsends, but
no, neither am I.
But
Miss Vines gave me a sense that I could go to university. She told me that I She told me I was intelligent and had capacity, and I could go to uni and make something of my life. And without that encouragement, I doubt that I would have got to university.
But, of course, you have also wavered on the brink with alcohol, drugs, street fighting, self-destructive impulses. And is it an ongoing struggle? Will it always be a struggle, do you think?
Well, I don't do that anymore, but my life is a struggle. I mean, I struggle every night with my voices. I have my MP3 player that I listen to. I struggle with my self-doubt. I struggle with trying to stay sane. Schizophrenia is an unendurable illness. It's awful, and it's very enigmatic as well. I sort of have this sense that they won't unlock the secret of it because it's so enigmatic. Mm. But I struggle with it, and the last 4 years in particular have been a real, just a horrible time. But even though I wrote my memoir during that time, I wrote the memoir Fighting Psychosis, Fighting Depression, and Fighting a Clozapine Stupor, I still get out of bed, though I have a mantra in the morning. I wake up and go, top myself, have brekkie, top myself, have brekkie. And the mantra just goes on. But I keep having brekkie, so the Nutri-Grain's working.
I've got to read another piece of your poetry here, which sums up what we've just been talking about. Peace of mind. There is no calm amidst the turmoil or a friendly glow to assuage the desperation. Ignorance talks of the comfort of madness. I talk of the far side of madness and the flames of hell. No, I shall never be the same. And yet, Sandy, I hear in your voice, and everyone's hearing it, you this indestructible humour.
I'm not indestructible. I'm very vulnerable and fragile, but I've just got to keep going. I have no choice. It's as bloody-minded as that. I've just got to keep going.
Five volumes of poetry are evidence that you are keeping going, aren't they?
Well, poetry's been very important to me. It's been my way of processing a lot of stuff, a lot of my life experiences. And I suppose if I have no spiritual nourishment from religion or transcendence from religion, but I get it in my poetry.
Do you know the first column I wrote for The Australian a million years ago, other than television reviews, which I used to do for years, was a piece in honour of a lyric by Paul Simon of Simon and Garfunkel.
Yeah, one of my favourite. They were the first poets to reach me.
That's why I mention it. me too, in a strange way. Them and Dylan, Simon and Dylan Thomas. But Simon and Garfunkel really mattered to you when you were a kid.
They did, and I just absorbed their lyrics so profoundly. Like, the mirror on the wall casts an image dark and small, yet I'm not sure at all it's my reflection. I mean, they were the first poets to reach me, And I think that it was as though they knew what I was going through and what I was struggling with. And when I couldn't find words myself to express how I felt, I just turned to Simon and Garfunkel.
I've always found the greatest therapy is writing. You know, the reason I started writing was to try and stay sane because I had a childhood not unlike your own.
Right.
And we are fortunate, Sandy, aren't we, that we can turn pain, well, a bit like an oyster, you know, with a painful bit of grit, the occasional pearl of poetry or even wisdom comes out of it.
I would like to think I had some wisdom, Philip, but I don't know. But I think surviving a childhood that's riven with violence and mayhem and madness and stuff, it's really hard to get through that. And of course, as a kid, you haven't got the tools or the language or the understanding to give it meaning yet. You haven't got the sophisticated analysis of society to see the violence in some productive way. And so just struggling with all that was extraordinarily difficult, and finding a way through it was just so hard, really hard stuff.
One of the great things you've done, one of the things you've done for yourself and for others, is to become a spokesperson for those living with schizophrenia and other mental illnesses. You talk at conferences to students, doctors. You've got awards for your efforts. And, of course, there was the performance piece composed by our mutual friend Elena.
Yes.
And choreographed by Meryl Tankard. Tell us about that.
Well, what's happening is Elena composed a piece of music based on a poem of mine, was scored for two pianos and a choir. But Elena and Meryl Tankard have been commissioned by the Joan Sutherland Performing Arts Centre to come up with a performance piece based on my poetry and my life. And they've had one session of workshopping it, and they're about to do another one in January before they hopefully can do a final performance of it. It's so exciting. I can't believe that my words and maybe my life can inspire people to compose music and dance and song from it. It just blows me away.
Sandy, you know, the statistics, I know they're awful bloody things, but they are so sobering. When you look at the number of people who suffer from mental illness, 1 in 5 in our country.
Yeah, it's huge, isn't it?
And of the homeless people, who, you know, the street people, so many of them are suffering, living with schizophrenia.
Yeah, it's a real indictment of our system at the moment, I think. And not that I'm saying we should go back to the old asylums, although, you know, I spent a lot of time in Larundel in Melbourne, which is a madhouse on the edge of town. And, I mean, I had some moments there that weren't too bad. I could talk to the roses, talk to the gum trees, I could walk around the paddocks. There was what I would call a vague amount of asylum there, but, you know, these days people go into an acute ward, they're let out after 5 or 10 days, and where do they go? Onto the street sometimes, into a horrible sort of living circumstance or whatever.
The great Oliver Sacks wrote an essay on asylums for New York a couple of years ago when he said they got a bad press. However, and he also argued that in many ways, and in some specific asylums, they did a pretty good job.
They did. I think we've lost the notion of asylum for the mad, though. You don't get asylum in an acute ward where you're processed through and rushed through really quickly. There's no sense now of giving people time and space in which to heal. With a psychotic episode, you don't get better in 10 or 12 days from a psychosis. It takes time to heal the mind. And I think we have lost any notion of asylum in our system at the moment.
Sandy, I've got to say goodbye to you. I've got to say goodbye to you now, but it's wonderful to talk with you. Flying with Paper Wings, published by the Vulgar Press. And when we sort out the copyright issues, we'll put the music and The Uninvited Stranger on our website. I know next a South African law professor about the recent spate of targeted rapes of lesbians in South Africa. They're being known as corrective rapes. And you can imagine the ghastly thinking behind that term. Stay tuned now on ABC Radio National for the news, and we will see you later.